This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
As we get ready for the new school year, a lot of students are making plans for life after high school. For the majority of those students, that means trying to get into the college of their choice. And that means it's time for another choice, the ACT or the SAT.
Colleges treat each equally. Every college will consider each score with the same weight.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to one of the authors of a book that helps you ace the ACT and find out some secrets for test-taking happiness. We'll also hear how one student confronted the SAT, hear about a new Georgetown University study on race and college admission, and spend an academic minute with some discrimination that's really early in life. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. As the last few weeks of summer fly by, a lot of high school seniors are making plans for next year, when many of them plan to move on to college. A big part of those plans involve choosing which entrance exam to take, the SAT or the ACT. We'll talk a little bit about both of these tests today, and first we'll hit the ACT. Chris Arp is one of the authors of Up Your Score ACT, the Underground Guide 2014-2015 edition. We spoke earlier this week about the test. The ACT test, that has been growing. Is it about equal to the SAT now?
It surpassed the SAT in 2012. It is now the most popular test in the nation.
By popularity, you mean the most taken or the most...
The most taken. I don't mean most loved.
Okay. How about most respected?
Colleges treat each equally. Every college will consider each score with the same weight.
What are the main differences between the tests?
Primarily, I think it boils down to two differences. One is that the ACT questions feel a lot more like homework that the kids have been doing before. They've seen these kinds of questions. If you look at a math question on the SAT, you have to work through it, think about it, before you might even know which concepts to apply. The ACT questions are far more straightforward. They look a lot more like the homework that kids have been doing for years. But perhaps a more important difference is that when kids take the ACT, after they've received their score, they choose whether or not to send the score off to college. And that's not true of the SAT. In the SAT, you take your score, it's out there. Colleges choose whether or not to look at it. But it's not your choice. And that really affects how it feels to take it. When a kid is taking the ACT, if it's not going so well, if they don't get the kind of score that they want, they can call it a mulligan, and they can take it 12 more times.
How does a student begin to prepare for the ACT? And is it very different from preparing for the SAT?
The ACT is a different test, and they want to first maybe look at both tests. I mean, if they live in Colorado, Michigan, Illinois, they have to take the ACT, so that's the test they're going to be taking. I recommend they only take one. One thing that we do in the book is we understand the kids are coming to us with different levels of preparation. Now, we're obviously hoping that all of them will buy the book this month. We have a 3-month plan where we tell them how to use the book. It's a relatively light load each week, how to take practice tests, what to do with that practice test. But let's say, hypothetically, that some kids aren't so pre-planned. If they come to us with only a month before the test, we have a 3-week plan for them to move through the book and take practice tests and get themselves ready. And then if they're really excellent at procrastinating, if they're like grade A procrastinators and they only have a couple days, we have a 3-day plan, which is kind of a crash course through the book. And then we do recommend they sign up to take the test again after taking it.
If a student is, he says, I have no problem with math, but my writing skills really need help. Are there ways to go through the book and just go to the writing sections?
Exactly. We have a chapter for each section so they can go right to the section they need help on. But we have an entire chapter on anxiety and stress. We have a separate chapter about how to organize your brain for when you're moving through the test. We have a whole chapter on what to do the night before the test. So we consider a lot of these side skills, like preparing yourself for anxiety or keeping a positive mind. These are things which we think are really crucial to your performance. We think that two kids can go to the ACT with the same amount of knowledge. They can both sit down to take the test. But the kid who knows how to move through the test in a way that limits his frustration or in a way that is speedier is going to get a far higher score than the kid who knows the same amount of stuff.
As you were putting the book together, who did you talk to more, teachers or students?
When we were writing it, we reached out to 3 high schoolers. These are kids who are now heading off to college in September. And they had all gotten perfect scores on the ACT, and we wrote it with them. So really, the book is kind of like walking into a room and hanging out with some teenagers who have just been through the process. When I first met these kids, these are kids who got perfect scores. When I first met them, I thought they'd be kind of levitating out of their chairs, like a foot out of their chairs. But they're normal kids. They're like you or me. But they have these strategies and these techniques and these philosophies of study that are all throughout the book. And I think it's really helpful for some kids to hear it from their peers as opposed to me just telling them.
The philosophy of study. Go into that a little bit more. I mean, you're not talking about a book where you just have to, you know, memorize questions and answers. You're talking about a way of studying.
Yeah, we're talking about how you think about your brain. We're talking about how you think about studying in terms of planning. We talk about how you think about your self-esteem as you're studying. We're talking about keeping track of your anxiety as you move through the test. We think that these are all crucial parts of the test. And the kids have a bunch of different strategies and techniques because the book assumes that kids are different, so different kids need different help when it comes to making sure that they're studying to maximize their time, or that they're not just pretend studying, or anxiety studying, or studying out of worry.
So what are the universals that every student should know before heading into this test?
Well, one thing that I'll tell them right off the bat, and this sounds very simple, is that when they're moving through the test, if a question starts to give them a bit of difficulty, they should skip that question, do two more, and then come back. There's a lot of reasons for this, and we go into it in the book. Your brain is processing the question even after you've moved on. You get a fresh read on the question. But most importantly, when they come back, their frustration level is not as high. They come back, and they haven't let it bother them. They haven't just stared at the problem with their frustration meter kind of raising and raising and raising in their body. They are nimble as they move through the section. And that's a crucial piece, and we repeatedly talk about that in each section so that kids are able to move through this very fast test without letting frustration get in their way.
I've asked this question before to people who did books about the SAT. I'll ask you, is there ever a time when it's okay to just close your eyes and guess?
We say that you must do that at times. One of the great things about the ACT is that they don't deduct points for a wrong answer. The SAT does. They take off a quarter of a point if you get it wrong. The ACT doesn't. So if you've skipped and come back a couple times and it's just not there, or you forgot how to do percents even though you knew 5 seconds ago, you must guess. But we talk about how to guess intelligently. In fact, on the back of the book we say, you'll get a PhD in guessing by the time you've gone through this book.
Chris Arp is one of the authors of Up Your Score ACT, the Underground Guide, 2014-2015 edition. While the ACT is a test that is growing, the gold standard for decades has been the College Board's Scholastic Aptitude Test, commonly known as the SAT. That test has been striking fear into the lives of about 1.5 million high school students every year who take the exam as part of the college application process. An SAT score is used by universities as a predictor of how well a student will perform as a college freshman. But many students say the test carries too much weight. Tirhas Kabriski tells us more.
I'm a high school senior, and I'm just starting to apply to colleges and universities. I'm pretty sure many people would consider me an exceptionally well-rounded student. I have over 100 hours of community service. I've made the honor roll every quarter for the past 3 years. My grade point average is 3.5, and I'm already taking some college-level courses. Getting into a good college on an academic scholarship should be a no-brainer, but it's not because of my SAT scores. I visited an SAT test center in Hinesville, Maryland, where 300 students were registered for the exam. When I arrived, the sun wasn't even up, but at least 25 anxious seniors were already there. Brenda Garcia was among them.
I'm a little nervous, but I'm okay because this is my second time taking it.
Alicia Caleb was also there.
I don't know what is on there. You know, I do know I have some information. I don't know. It might be stressing me out during the test, but right now I'm fine.
Now we're going to start the test.
At exactly 8:20 a.m., with tensions high, students filed into classrooms to receive the instructions. A low SAT score can mean a denied admission to the school of your choice or no hope for financial aid. The test is not easy. Here's a typical math question. A perfect cube is an integer whose cube root is an integer. For example, 27, 64, and 125 are perfect cubes. If P and Q are perfect cubes, which of the following will not necessarily be a perfect cube? A, 8P, B, PQ, C, PQ plus 27, D, negative P, or E, P minus Q to the 6th power. The correct answer is C, PQ plus 27. Did you get it right? After taking the SAT, many students were relieved, but Faye Edokoya, a 17-year-old Bladensburg High School senior, was a bit annoyed.
I don't feel like that should determine our whole college career, our whole future, basically. It's like it's either you make it or you break it, you know?
But Chase McMillan, who also attends Bladensburg High, thought the test had merit.
I think it's fair. A lot of students might not see it as fair, but we have to realize that as students, we need to match what the College Board has set for us.
Sarah Gundy is the Senior Associate Director of Admissions at the University of Maryland in College Park.
Don't beat yourself up. Prepare, study, do what you're supposed to be doing in school, and then you're ready to take the standardized test.
But many American students perform poorly on the SAT. For example, in 2006 in Prince George's County, students scored an average of 1,300 points out of 2,400. Nationwide, the average score was only 1,600. Where do these students end up?
One of the great things about the American system of higher education is that there is a college for every student.
Brian O'Reilly is the executive director of SAT program relations at the College Board headquarters in New York.
So even the student who has not done well throughout high school can go to college. And if they do well in college, they can start at a community college, move up to a four-year institution, go on to graduate school. There are all sorts of paths that students can follow and all sorts of forks in the road where they can change that path.
To make that path easier, 16-year-old Arsema Zacharias is already getting ready.
Well, I'm just starting out my junior year, taking the SAT prep course, but I feel like I need it to start, you know, ever since my freshman year.
SAT prep courses are often available for free in public schools, but private prep courses like Kaplan and Princeton Review can cost anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000. But Faye Edokoya says taking an SAT prep course isn't always enough to guarantee a good score.
You know, some people who live in, like, let's say, Beverly Hills, you know, they're rich and they have all whatever. They get the opportunity to sit there and get prepared for while they're young and get all these, like, $2,000 tutors and blase, blase. And then you got people who are living in stuff like Kentland. They don't have that much money to be getting $2,000 tutors or something like that.
I've decided to retake the SAT. But I'm not as nervous about it because I have other options. Trinity College in D.C. places less emphasis on the SAT and more emphasis on other academic qualifications. Anna DeLeon is Trinity's Associate Director of Admissions.
We really look at the comprehensive information that we receive from students, their application, their transcripts, letters of recommendation. We really look at the overall picture.
Many students believe their SAT score should not stop them from going to the college of their choice or from winning a scholarship. Because after all, the SAT is just one test. Alicia Caleb couldn't agree more.
The grades could tell you enough. I don't think you need a test. I think everybody should be able to go to college if they want to. We're a winner.
That report from Tiras Kabrisky was part of the Youth Voices series on WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C. Still to come, regardless of which test they take, minority students still seem to have a hard time getting into the top U.S. schools. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the Programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1194. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. This past June, the Supreme Court could have sent a lot of college admissions offices into a turmoil by striking down a ruling that upheld the University of Texas at Austin's affirmative action guidelines. The conversation about race and who gets to go to what school has been going on for a while, and there seems to be no end in sight. On the heels of the court's decision, the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce released a new study with a provocative title, Separate and Unequal: How Higher Education Reinforces the Intergenerational Reproduction of White Racial Privilege. Here to talk about that study is Anthony Carnevale, director and research professor at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. We spoke recently, and I asked him about the court's decision.
The Fisher decision essentially kicked the ball down the road. They sent the case back to Texas and said, "We don't think you look closely enough." Now, what most people think that means is, in the case of Texas, they had used race all by itself in some cases, but they had also used what's called the 10% solution, which is if you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you get into the elite school. So most people think, as the court said, you can't use race alone. If you use race in combination with class, with indicators like whether you're in the top 10% of your high school class, whether you come from a family with low income, then we'll let you get by with this. But you can't use race alone.
Your study, what did that find? Are the top performers getting into the top schools?
We found a couple of interesting and somewhat disturbing things. It's really a good news, bad news story, and that is a lot more African Americans and Latinos are going to college, but they're going to the least selective colleges, and that has powerful implications for their life chances. Since 1995, more than 80% of the white kids who've gone on to college are going to the top 468 colleges, and more than 70% of the African American and Latino kids that are going to college are going to the open admission two-year community colleges and open admission four-year schools.
Why is that important? Why is going to one of the top schools important for a student of any type?
In the end, the polarization of the American higher education system by race matters because money matters. That is, if you go to one of the top 468 colleges, the college will spend five times as much on you every year as the college in the less selective tier would spend on you. You get much higher graduation rates. If you go to the top 468 colleges, your chance of graduation is about 84% if you get an above average test score on the ACT or SAT. And if you go to one of the less selective two-year or four-year schools, your graduation rate will only be about 49%, or your expected graduation rate will be 49%. And if you go one of the selective colleges, you're much more likely to go to graduate school, which adds a cool $2 million to your lifetime earnings.
Well, let's stay with money. Is this more of a financial issue than a racial issue, or is it a bit of both?
It is a bit of both. In the end, what we find that is disturbing is that higher education has become part of the colorblind machinery in American education, because this is not bigotry, I don't think. It's that our economic and educational mechanisms are consistently favoring affluent white kids and consistently having a disproportionate negative effect on Latinos and African Americans and lower income white kids, even when they're qualified to go to the better school. Money is probably a primary factor, but another factor that is quite striking is information. We find that even students who are qualified to go to selective colleges, if they're a minority or low income, they don't really know how to get there. So we find that there are 240,000 lower income students in the United States, in the lower half of the income distribution, every year who score on the top half of the ACT, SAT test score distribution, but they don't go to these selective colleges. And we find that there are 111,000 African American and Latino students every year who are qualified but don't go.
Are high school, say, guidance offices not doing their job in helping guide a student towards the way they can get to one of these colleges?
There are a lot of
problems here. One is that kids who go to schools that have large shares of African-American, Latino, or low-income students don't have counselors. That is, if they do, they have about one counselor for every 400 or 500 kids. And there really isn't any counseling for the broad mass of American youth. Our counseling system is really very much in disrepair. And the other thing that goes on here is that even though a lot of colleges look for high-achieving minorities and low-income kids, they don't look that hard. That is, they're not looking far enough. We found that out in a number of our studies, as have some other people who've made this effort to try and track the fates of these kids, that the schools really don't find them. I mean, they only look in the places where they look before. They go to the right prep schools and the right high schools, and there they can find some high-achieving minorities and sometimes some low-income kids, although much less often, by the way. And they don't tend to search very far and wide.
What then can families and students and parents do to, you know, make those schools notice their kids?
I think the important thing for parents and students to know is it does matter where you go. So it's important to find out what your prospects are. It's important to know the graduation rate of the institution that you're thinking of attending. If it's 30%, then watch out. And then the other kinds of information are where are you going to get money to do this. This problem is so large, we're talking about millions of students in the end, that we're simply going to need a different kind of system, that is one that is much more sensitive to finding all of the able students who are out there and creating more of them.
Anthony Carnevale is director and research professor at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. To many, it's no surprise that discrimination may be in play with regards to college selection, but some biases start even earlier in life, much earlier. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. In many strongly patriarchal societies around the world, the birth of a son is still valued more than the birth of a daughter. And as Leah Lakdawalla, assistant professor of economics at Michigan State University, reveals, gender bias often begins well before the first labor pains.
My co-author and I were discussing how boys and girls are often treated differently in India, when a thought struck us. What if the spread of ultrasound technology allowed families to start discriminating even before birth? After examining data from over 30,000 Indian women, we find evidence that women who are pregnant with boys are more likely to visit antenatal clinics, more likely to receive tetanus shots, and also more likely to deliver their babies in a non-home environment, such as a health facility or hospital. In a world where parents treat boys and girls equally, there is little reason to expect such a systematic relationship between fetal gender and prenatal care. In northern India, where sex discrimination is known to be more prevalent, we find that the gender gap in prenatal care is even larger. We see similar evidence of preferential treatment for boys in other patriarchal countries, such as China, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. We believe these results are very important because maternal inputs during pregnancy can affect health outcomes such as neonatal survival and birth weight. For example, if women are more likely to receive tetanus shots when pregnant with a boy, this difference in prenatal care may lead to fewer girls surviving past the first month after birth. Not only does prenatal care have immediate effects on infant health, but previous research has linked early childhood health to later life outcomes such as educational attainment, IQ, and adult wages. This implies that the gender discrimination in prenatal care may contribute to long-term differences between men and women.
That was Leah Lakdawalla of Michigan State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.